Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, I thought we'd lead off today's episode with a bit of a recap.
A recap?
A recap.
All right. What are we recapping?
Maybe it's more of an update.
Is that when your hat blows off and you put it back on? You recapped?
Episode 59.
I made a funny at library class today.
Did you?
Yeah.
What's library class?
Well, that's where I take Charlie and Cooper on Wednesdays when I get to keep them for a few hours. And I take them to the class at the library where they read some stories and stuff and do a craft and some things. And they were doing one about, it was about aliens today, and they were doing this one about how aliens all want our underpants. And okay. They come to Earth to get our underpants. And that's what the story was about, basically. And they said, sometimes they want our underpants so they can have races in them. And I raised my hand and the lady reading said, yes. And I said, I've heard of one of those races. She said, you have? And I said, yes. It was the Indianapolis 500.
Was it a children's book?
Yeah, okay. It was a children's book. And so she laughed. She said, that's good. Did you just make that up? I said, yes, I did. I do it kind of for a living.
And you got a gold star for the day.
Yeah, she liked that. The other mothers in there, it's just me, old grandpa, me, and the mothers. So
so it's fitting you're in there. You're making the dad jokes.
That's right. I have to, for the dads are all at work.
So episode 59, we discussed the Fourth Amendment. As it pertained to forced blood draws. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So I was. We were going to do an episode on some amendments today. We're going to talk about the Sixth Amendment, but I thought I'd make sure we hadn't done the Sixth Amendment before, which I don't believe we have. But I came across the fact we had done the Fourth Amendment, and there were some updates to that story, so I thought we'd share them.
Was that about like where the police were taking somebody's blood if they were unconscious?
That's right.
That was okay?
There was an accident, and they were trying to forcibly have a nurse take someone's blood at the emergency room, and she refused, and they arrested her and took her into custody.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
There's a whole video of her, like, right, arguing and being arrested and things like that. Well, she received a $500,000 settlement for that.
Well, I think that she should.
Yeah. And she actually donated some of it to different charities and to things like that, so she was pretty gracious with the settlement itself.
I didn't get any.
Me either, but, you know, what are you going to do? And so the Jeff Payne, who was the deputy and the detective, he was actually fired from his job, and he actually is filing a lawsuit against his former employer too for terminating him. So the
lawyers are winning on this more than anything.
Yeah, he said that basically he felt that he acted within the law and the policy of what he was supposed to do, and he's suing for wrongful termination and $1.5 million in damages. He said he basically holds no ill will towards the nurse, whose name was Wibbles, if you remember that correctly.
Wibbles wobble, but they don't fall down.
You made that same exact joke in that episode.
Hey, at least I'm consistent.
And yeah.
Not imaginative.
And Payne says he believes that they were both just doing their jobs, but because there was conflict, he was the one that bears most of the burden from this.
Well, so, there's a way to go about it and a way not to go about it. I mean, you can't, like, grab the nurse in a chokehold and say, do it, damn it, do it.
And here's the interesting thing. He claims that Wibbles, and she's actually a former Olympic skier. I don't think we covered that before, but she's a former Olympic skier. Her life has kind of gone upward because of the way she acted in the situation. He says his life has been ruined And that basically he's working a job right now that barely pays minimum wage and he's struggling to keep his household together.
Well, you know, if you believe in karma, then you'd say there's your answer as to who was right and who was wrong.
That would be true.
Mm-hmm. So, that's what I would say. Yeah. Karma's a bitch.
But that was a little update to episode 59 from the Fourth Amendment. But today we're going to talk about the Sixth Amendment and what it covers and actually how it's one of the more important amendments when it comes to the rights of the accused.
I've usually found that you can find the Sixth Amendment right between the Fifth and the Seventh.
That's true. Generally, that's where it's found.
When looking, you know, using the Dewey Decimal System, that's where you can find it.
So the way the Sixth Amendment reads is this, and it's actually, of all the amendments and the way they're written, it spells out the most, I think, of any of the Bill of Rights. I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, you're going to talk a little bit about interpretation, but it's pretty clear what it stands for.
You could tell what they were trying to accomplish in writing it.
Yeah. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. So it's pretty clear what it says there. And it's funny, I was thinking about this when we're getting ready, and basically, whenever you enter any kind of plea to a criminal matter, especially for felonies, maybe not so much for misdemeanors, but you actually have to fill out what's called a plea questionnaire. And this is something, a form that I have to go over with my client and ask them questions and write down the answers and then go back over it with them again to make sure that those are the correct answers and make sure they don't have any questions. And so I go over this anytime we're doing any kind of a plea before the court. I do this before I go into court and fill out this form with them. And then when we're in open court, the judge goes over it again and then directs them to sign to make sure that their responses are all accurate. So I actually brought in a plea of guilty questionnaire here to kind of go over because a lot of it has to do with the Sixth Amendment.
All right.
It says, have you been furnished with a copy of the indictment under which you were charged? So basically that goes straight to the Sixth Amendment, and it talks about to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. So to make sure you want to know exactly what the cause and
what exactly are you accusing me of?
What are you accused of? They say, what is the charge made against you? Have you had the opportunity to read the indictment or have it read for you? Then they go on, have you had a chance to confer with your attorney? So there's, again, the right to counsel again.
Right to counsel. So that's in there.
They want to know if your lawyers advised you and had told you you have the right to a trial by jury. So again, talking about the right to a trial by jury, which is in the Sixth Amendment as well. Yep.
Yes,
trial.
It is.
Impartial jury.
Impartial jury at that.
An impartial
Not
jury.
Not just any
that.
Jury, but an impartial one.
Do you feel you've been adequately represented by your lawyer? Usually my clients say yes, which is always a good thing. Do you understand you don't have to plead guilty? Do you understand that if you enter a plea of not guilty, you're entitled to a trial by jury? Do you understand the state is required to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? In our state, it says that the jury verdict has to be unanimous. In some states, that's not the case, but most of them it is.
Right.
Say you have the right to remain silent during a trial. That goes back to the Fifth Amendment to not incriminate yourself. Do you understand that you have the right to call witnesses in your own defense? So you can put on your own defense. You can call your own witnesses. And that you basically have compulsory process to get those witnesses there. So you have the power to subpoena witnesses on your behalf to come to court. Now, you might not like what they say, but you have the power to bring them there.
Well, you better not bring them if you're not going to like what they're going to say.
That's true.
Only a fool represents himself.
That's right. The other question here, do you understand that you have the right to have witnesses against you take the stand in your presence, and they may be cross-examined on your behalf by your lawyer?
And that's face your accuser.
That's right, the confrontation clause.
He's a lying, Judge. He's a lying. Everybody in the county knows that's the lionest pig in the county. Sheep, I think it actually was. It wasn't a pig. It was a sheep.
Well, you know, they're notorious for their
some veracity. Type of livestock.
Yeah, livestock. And the final question is, do you now waive your right to a trial by jury? So I want to make sure that you understand that you do have the ultimate right to a trial by jury. So this questionnaire is basically almost verbatim going through the Sixth Amendment so you understand all these rights that you have whenever you're entering a plea of guilty.
Well, so it's also a CYA for the lawyer, because if all those things aren't done, then the guy could be acquitted even if he's guilty.
Right. Well, they can come back later.
The Sixth Amendment's violated.
They can come back later and say that basically they had ineffective assistance of counsel, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But yeah, so it is kind of a CYA thing too, but you want, it kind of lays out that the person understood exactly what it is that their rights were, and they have the opportunity to exercise them freely.
Well, I guess even though we didn't delve into the Sixth Amendment, we referred to it a lot on the episode where we talked about traffic cameras.
Yeah, we did.
Because that's the one that they're violating when you can't confront your accuser because it was a camera.
Exactly.
And the people that monitor it are some third party that don't really know what they're doing or something.
Yeah, and they actually wouldn't even testify at court.
Yeah, they would just show up.
They're the ones that issue the thing. And they actually didn't observe it themselves.
Right.
They had a camera that brought it to their attention. So
we referred to it a lot during that episode. We just didn't go into
We did. And that's essentially just the confrontation clause is what that is.
Right.
But as you can tell, there's a lot more in the Sixth Amendment than just that.
Confrontation clause. He was the brother that got kicked out of the North Pole because he just couldn't get along with anybody.
It was very
Santa and Commerce had enough,
yeah,
and they just kicked him out.
We do not approve of your pugilistic behaviors. Confrontation clause. Leave the North Pole.
Move elsewhere.
Go to the South Pole. Down with those ruffians.
I'm going to go there and establish a law firm. That's what I'm going to do.
So the other thing that that's not contained in the plea questionnaire, but you mentioned before, is the right to a speedy trial. And there's an ancient maxim, a legal maxim, that says justice delayed is justice denied.
Ooh.
How profound is that?
That sounds like some lawyer's tagline to get you to call him.
Yeah. Call me now. Justice delayed is justice denied.
So don't delay. Call now. Switchboard operators are standing by 24/7.
Yeah.
Kind of like they're still switchboard operators.
That plays well off our lawyer advertising last episode.
That's right. It goes right along with it.
Was that last episode?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was the last one.
I thought so.
Yeah. Legal advertising. That was it.
It's been a whirlwind week.
I know. You're busy. You new married guys. You're just busy all the time.
Well, and also been clearing up the calendar a little bit, going on vacation next week. So.
Yeah, and I'm going right after you. So we're going to have a tough time keeping up with our podcasting duties.
That's right.
We're going to do our best.
But our listeners have a right to a speedy podcast, so we're going to do our best to keep that up.
We'll have to load them in the chamber. Not the star chamber, though.
Not the star chamber. Now, didn't you have a case that you were talking about that was interpreted what was a speedy trial?
Yeah, well, there's one of the things when I did my research on this was one of the things that
I always love when you do the legal research.
Well, I have to know what I'm talking about, kind of. I have to at least know which direction we're going. While this amendment seems to be pretty succinct in all the things that it covers, there's a whole lot of these things that are open to interpretation.
Right.
So it says you have the right to a speedy trial. All right. What is a speedy trial? Is it a week? Is it 2 weeks? Is it 6 months? Is it a year?
Right.
When is it not a speedy trial?
Yeah.
And what are the repercussions if you don't give somebody a speedy trial? You know, so that was kind of what I was wondering is how do these things work? And you go through and there's all kinds of Supreme Court cases that have tried to define all the different aspects of the Sixth Amendment. So this is something that has been challenged or people have tried to use it to their advantage. And the one that found first was Barker v. Wingo. And it said, on July 20th, 1958, an elderly couple in Christian County, Kentucky, were murdered in their home by intruders later identified as Willie Barker and Silas Manning.
That's a scary name, Silas.
Yeah. So, said, believing that the case against Manning was the stronger of the two and that Manning's testimony was needed to convict Barker, then the prosecution chose to try Manning first, hoping that once convicted, Manning would later voluntarily testify against Barker. At the outset of Manning's trial on October 23, 1958, the prosecution sought and obtained the first of what would be 16 continuances in Barker's trial. So that's what the main point is. They're not even trying Manning. They're just holding him in jail. And Barker, they're trying to try him. Well, this guy goes through 16 continuances. The prosecution, however, encountered numerous difficulties in getting a conviction against Manning, and it would not be until December of 1962. Now, remember, the crime was committed in 1958.
Uh-huh.
1962, that Manning would be convicted in the second of the two murders. the prosecution would seek a continuance in the Barker case until the beginning of the following term while the Manning case was ongoing. Barker, through his counsel, did not object to any of the first 11 continuances, but on the 12th continuance, in February of 62, Barker's counsel filed a motion to dismiss on the grounds of a speedy trial, and it was rejected. Barker's counselor did not object to the 13th or 14th continuances, but then again objected on the 15th continuance. The prosecution sought continuance due to the illness of the former sheriff then for Barker's trial, as well as the 16th continuance. Then June 1963 requested for the sheriff's continued illness while granting the continuance. The circuit court ruled that the matter had to come to trial at the next term or would be dismissed for lack of prosecution. The final trial date was set on October 9th, 1963. So 5 years after he committed the crime,
right,
he finally got his day in court.
Was he incarcerated the whole time, I wonder?
I think he was.
See, that's way too long.
Yeah, and that was, so they just filed that, look, he didn't get a speedy trial. He needs to be let go. And you know, I kind of agree with him. But so he appealed it to the Kentucky Court of Appeals. In 1970, Barker filed a habeas corpus petition in the United States District Court for the Western District of Kentucky, and the district court denied the petition. But it granted Barker the right to proceed in former pauperis.
Right.
And a certificate of probable cause to appeal.
Right. So basically that means he was
kicked on upstairs.
Well, if they granted it in form of paupers, that means that he filed a pauper's affidavit, meaning he was broke.
Okay.
So they waived all the fees and things like that.
All right. Then the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit affirmed the district court's decision in 1971. The Sixth Circuit argued that Barker had waived any speedy trial claims up through February 1963, which the Sixth Circuit erroneously believed was the first date that Barker's counsel objected to further continuance, and that the eight-month period between February and October 1963, the period between the objection and the actual trial, was not unduly long. Further, the Sixth Circuit ruled that granting a continuance based on the sheriff's illness was a justifiable reason. So then the United States Supreme Court granted a writ of certiorari in 1972. But then the Supreme Court, here were the things that they noted that the speedy trial is generically different from any of the other rights enshrined in the Constitution for the protection of the accused, and it's inherently different for three reasons. First, the court noted, there is a social interest in providing a speedy trial which exists separate from and at times in opposition to the interests of the accused. The court commented on the backlog of cases, mainly in urban courts, that often enable defendants to negotiate a plea for a lesser offense. The court also noted that persons released on bond had the opportunity to commit further crimes. The longer an accused is free awaiting trial, the more tempting becomes his opportunity to jump bail and escape, and that delay between arrest and punishment may have a detrimental effect on rehabilitation. The court also noted that if the accused cannot make bail, that too can make rehabilitation difficult, that a lengthy pretrial detention can be costly, and that society loses wages which might have been earned, and it must often support families of incarcerated breadwinners. Second, the court noted that deprivation of the right may work to the accused advantage. At the time between arrest and trial lengthens, witnesses become unavailable and or their memories fade. Just like you said, justice delayed is justice denied. And then thirdly, the court noted that the concept is more vague than with other rights, and that the court cannot definitely say how long is too long in a system where justice is supposed to be swift but deliberate. So they were two different methods, but neither of which are accepted as far as determining how long is too long. One is supported by the American Bar Association as to hold that the Constitution requires a criminal defendant to be offered a trial within a specified time period. The court rejected this approach, stating that there was no constitutional basis for holding that speedy trial. The right can be quantified into a specific number of days or months. So they're saying they can't name it.
Yeah.
You know, the lawyer, the American Bar, was wanting them to set it, whatever it was.
Yeah, this is it.
And say, this is it. But they said, no, you can't do that. And the other approach was to restrict consideration of the right to those cases in which the accused has demanded a speedy trial. In other words, if the defendant did not specifically demand a trial, the defendant waived his or her right to appeal the matter. The court also rejected this approach as it considered a speedy trial to be a fundamental right. And quoting Carnley v. Cochran, the court ruled that presuming waiver from a silent record is impermissible. The record must show, or there must be an allegation and evidence which show, that an accused was offered counsel, but intelligently and understandably rejected the offer. Anything less is not a waiver.
Yeah. In West Virginia, you typically, if you want to ensure that you have a speedy trial, you file a motion for a speedy trial. It's kind of one of the standard pretrial motions you file a lot of times.
Oh, really? Was that because he had never filed something like that?
No. And also, in West Virginia, you generally have to be tried in the same term of court in which you were indicted. So the grand jury meets 4 times a year. So that means generally you have to be tried within 3 months. But it can also be continued for good cause shown. But they try to try people within the same term of court as when you were indicted.
Well, and they said, generally speaking, you try to keep it under a year.
Right.
Is what they do. But they said that the four legs that they balance this on is the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, the time and manner in which the defendant has asserted his right, and the degree of prejudice to the defendant which the delay has caused. So taking those factors into consideration, Barker's conviction was upheld. The court agreed that the period of time between an initial arrest and trial, even though it was over 5 years, it was extraordinary, but that only 7 months of the delay was justifiable because of the sheriff's illness. However, the court also ruled that Barker was not prejudiced by the delay, since none of Barker's witnesses were harmed by the delay. More importantly, the court determined that Barker did not want a speedy trial, a fact that Barker's counsel conceded to at oral argument, which seems strange.
Yeah.
The court speculated that Barker's reason was he was gambling on Manning's acquittal. So he wanted him to be tried first.
Right.
And then the evidence against Manning was not strong, and so it hung up 2 juries, and then you had 2 appellate court reversals. So, you know, he didn't do anything to move it along, and they're saying he didn't have any damage as a result of it.
Well, there's a case-by-case analysis you have to take, I think, as a defense attorney. And sometimes having a speedy trial can be a good thing, because a lot of times cases do drag on for quite some time and they get continued and nobody's ready for trial. There's delays in discovery and there's plea negotiations. So, you know, things get continued. But there is something to be said for when your client gets indicted, you file that motion for a speedy trial and you stick your foot on the gas pedal and you push it straight down and you just go as fast as you can. And there's some times where you might catch the prosecution not ready because you're pushing the pace of the case. You're the one dictating the pace of the case. So that can actually be a good tactic to use sometimes. Now, you have to also look at that for other considerations. I mean, in a case like that one, obviously hoping that Manning gets acquitted first, you know, you might not want to push the pace of the case. You might see if that guy gets off too.
You probably want to file that motion up front about the speedy trial.
Yeah, probably. I think there's an argument to be made that it is a fundamental constitutional right. So by not filing it, you're not
giving it up.
Not giving it up. But I think it solidifies it a lot more. If you put it in writing and file it, you're like, oh, this guy's serious. He wants a speedy trial.
Yeah, that's just it. If it's a right and it's in there, you shouldn't have to ask for it.
No, but it makes it pretty much unequivocal that you want it if you file a motion for it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another case.
The one thing that reminded me of, remember that lawyer that was also in the legislature that put off all those cases?
Yeah.
But those were all personal injuries, and this is only applying to cases that involve people going to prison.
No, those were criminal trials. Those were criminal ones because they were DUIs and things like that. Because remember, that was we were talking about victims' rights.
Oh, well then, but by him doing that, then he's keeping someone. Well, I guess what we're saying is, as a plaintiff, you don't have the right to a speedy trial, just as a defendant. And that's what he was doing.
We're talking about as a victim, you don't have a right to a speedy trial. So basically, these victims were saying, hey.
Right. The defendants are the only ones that have the right to it.
Exactly.
So he was defending all the defendants, and they wanted it to drag out.
Right. Because your case actually statistically does improve the longer your chances of acquittal are greater.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, again, if you push the pace of the case, sometimes that can work in your favor, too. It's not a bad tactic. I've seen it used before. Now, this other case was kind of interesting. It was a Doggett v. United States. I just wanted to say that name.
Doggett. God, Doggett, get in here.
Supreme Court, and this is 1992, and the Supreme Court determined that Doggett was 8.5 years waiting for trial, that actually violated his Sixth Amendment rights, which I think that's probably a fair number there. 8.5 years. Yeah, we can probably do better than that.
Was he in prison the whole time?
Yeah. Yeah, incarcerated, mm-hmm. waiting for trial. Now, that does also bring up a practice point, too. If you have a client who sits in jail awaiting trial, and they've been in there for, say, you know, two years or something waiting for trial, and then they get offered a plea, sometimes it makes sense to take that plea regardless, just because you've already got so much time in, you're eligible for parole the second you take that plea.
Right.
So you're probably getting out by taking the plea. So sometimes it makes sense. And also, especially if you have multiple counts, so you plead to one thing, you're eligible for parole, or you take it to trial, and you might get those things run consecutive, and then you wouldn't be eligible for parole for a while. So sometimes that can play into your strategy in representing your client, too, how long they've been in. So you actually have to be able to compute somebody's potential jail sentence and also the time they have for time served when you're advising them for a possible plea. Because sometimes it does make sense to take a plea to something that you might have a good case of to possibly try to win, just because the exposure doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be getting out if you take this plea deal. Do you want to do it? You know, I think you have a good trial. We can go to trial, but we might lose. Nobody knows what a jury's going to do. What do you want to do? So those are all things you have to point out for your client and let them decide what it is they want to do.
You said that he was acquitted because of that. After that 8.5 years, he was let go. Well, that in Strunk v. United States in 1973, the Supreme Court ruled that if the reviewing court finds that a defendant's right to a speedy trial was violated, then the indictment must be dismissed and or the conviction overturned. The court held that since the delayed trial is a state action which violates a defendant's rights, no other remedy would be appropriate. Thus, a reversal or dismissal of a criminal case on speedy trial grounds means that no further prosecution for the alleged offense can take place.
Yeah, dismissed with prejudice.
But here again, it's something that they had to go to the Supreme Court and interpret.
Yeah.
You know, all right, well, what do we do? What do we do if we do violate the speedy trial? It doesn't really say. It just says you can't do it. So they had to come up. That 1973, that's what surprises me.
Yeah.
Before they made the determination, well, here's what happens if you violate that.
Well, there's some very important motions that you have to file.
Yes.
They're motions for court costs. Who do we have on the docket today?
Oh, well, you surprised me. Well, we have on the docket our good friends at BetterHelp.com.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals?
Not right at this moment, but if I did, I bet I would know who to call.
That's right.
BetterHelp. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
There is a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's, and that's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas.
I said it once, say it again. A rural area like West Virginia, a lot of times you don't have access to the different counselors. It's hard to find somebody.
Well, but it's a long drive over bumpy roads.
That's right. Country roads at that.
Take me home.
So this service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
You will get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room with old stale magazines, with traditional therapy.
I hate old stale magazines.
Me too.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
Be happy. don't worry. Be happy.
Bobby McFerrin said it best.
That's right. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily.
Visit BetterHelp.com/court. That's better. H-E-L-P, and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of experienced professional.
And there's a special offer just from Court Appointed. For Court Appointed listeners, get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/court. And feel better with their help.
You know, I was kind of having a bit of a rough day, and then I thought about Bobby McFerrin. It made me happier.
Well, there you go. He said, don't worry, be happy.
That's right.
That's all there is to it.
So now one of the other things that is outside the scope of speedy trial, another thing the Sixth Amendment guarantees, is the right to counsel.
This is correct.
And not just any counsel.
Good counsel.
Competent counsel.
Competent counsel. Oh, yeah, you always said you like to try to appear competent for your prospective clients.
I do. It's very important. Competency cannot be overrated or not stressed enough.
All right.
So basically, a criminal defendant has the right to have a lawyer even if they can't pay for an attorney themselves. And this was first discussed in Gideon v. Wainwright, which was 1963. So it was actually not done prior to that. So that's when you first had the right to counsel. So even though it said you had the right to counsel, it was memorialized in this 1963 Gideon v. Wainwright. So one question is basically, when does the right to counsel actually attach? You have the right to counsel, but when does that happen? I mean, just because the police are talking to you before they arrest you, does that mean you have the right to counsel then?
Yes.
No.
Oh.
Not the court-appointed counsel.
Oh, not the court-appointed. You can call your lawyer.
You can have your own lawyer there.
I need my mouthpiece.
That's right. So basically, in Brewer v. Williams, a 1977 case, the Supreme Court held that a defendant gains the right to an attorney at or after the time that judicial proceedings have been initiated against him or her, well, against him, whether by formal charge, preliminary hearing, indictment, information, or arraignment. So basically, whenever there are formal charges brought, that's when the right to counsel attaches. Now, one thing that was kind of interesting, it was clarified in a 1984 case, and basically the court said that an inmate who was suspected of committing murder while in prison, they lacked the right to counsel while in administrative segregation prior to the indictment, because the segregation happens before the initiation of adversarial proceedings. So even though they're incarcerated awaiting trial on this, they're incarcerated essentially for something else, and they hadn't been indicted yet on that charge, they didn't have the right to counsel. So they were in a separate kind of a holding facility, but they didn't have the right to counsel because the judicial proceedings had not yet been initiated.
Hmm.
So kind of interesting little turn there. Now, the one thing that is very important, and I mentioned this previously, is you have the right to effective counsel. And that's always an issue on appeal. Anytime there's an appeal in a criminal case, it's always ineffective assistance of counsel. That's just guaranteed.
He didn't do his job, and that's why they freebie.
Nothing personal. It's just always in there. And whenever there's an appeal, the prior guy didn't do his job. So that's
they're
always
just like contractors.
Yeah.
That's why you bring in a contractor, look at something, he'll say, who did this other work? Boy, they were lousy. Yeah, I should have done it. Every contractor will criticize the one before him.
Yeah. Well, I think attorneys don't want to necessarily do that, but they realize a lot of times they don't have any other recourse because everything else was done right. And other attorneys, I think if somebody points out a mistake and you screwed up, actually, if you want to help represent your client further, you would say, yeah, I maybe did screw that up a little bit. You know, that helps your client get out of the situation. So the court determined a test to establish what is an effective assistance of counsel. And that comes from a Strickland v. Washington case, 1984. And it's a two-prong test to determine whether a court-appointed attorney has given the proper amount of care to their client. The first is the error prong, whether the counselor's performance is deficient under the circumstances, with performance being measured under the standard of prevailing professional norms. And this basically relies a lot upon custom in the area. So what would be custom in this area might not be custom in, say, California. So there's different things. So you're kind of basically held to the same standard as local attorneys here.
Mm-hmm.
The prejudice prong, whether the lawyer's supposed subpar conduct affected with reasonable probability the trial's outcome. So you're looking at kind of like but-for causation. So basically that but-for the counsel's unprofessional errors, this result of the proceedings would have been different. So
but-for.
Yeah, but-for. So that happens a lot of times in these cases. You'll cite all these things that the attorney screwed up, and you'll say this and this and this, and they didn't do it right. And the court might even say, yeah, you're right. He probably didn't do that right, or she didn't do that right. Yeah, they screwed that up. Yeah, screwed that up too. Well, but you know what? It was harmless error. Because it really would not have changed the outcome.
No harm, no foul.
Yeah. So
no blood, no foul.
You'll point out all these things that are wrong, but it won't matter because it'll be harmless error. So that's kind of the basically that prejudice prong. They really aren't prejudiced because it didn't affect the outcome of the trial. And so basically, but if you do prove the ineffective assistance of counsel, the remedy is that they get a new trial. So that's kind of the way it works.
You know, you'd think that's one of the easiest things to interpret out of the Sixth Amendment is that if you can't afford counsel, one will be provided, right?
Right.
But that has gone through many delineations of what exactly, who exactly gets a lawyer if they can't afford it.
That's true.
And it started with Powell v. Alabama in 1932. And in that, the Supreme Court ruled that in a capital case where the defendant is unable to employ counsel and is incapable of adequately making his own defense because of ignorance, feeble-mindedness, illiteracy, or the like, it is the duty of the court, whether requested or not, to assign counsel for him. Then,
good job, court. If the person is mentally incompetent, you're going to give them, in a capital case,
yeah,
you're going to give them a lawyer. Good job.
In Johnson v. Zerbst in 1938, the Supreme Court ruled that in all federal cases, counsel would have to be appointed for defendants who were too poor to hire their own. So in 1961, the court extended the rule that applied in federal courts to state courts. It held in Hamilton v. Alabama in 1961 that counsel had to be provided at no expense to defendants in capital cases when they so requested, even if there was no ignorance, feeble-mindedness, illiteracy, or the like. Then Gideon v. Wainwright, 1963, ruled that counsel must be provided to indigent defendants in all felony cases, overruling Betts v. Brady, which was in 1942, in which the court ruled that state courts had to appoint counsel only when the defendant demonstrated special circumstances requiring the assistance of counsel. Under Argersinger v. Hamilton in 1972, counsel must be appointed in any case resulting in a sentence of actual imprisonment. Regarding sentences not immediately leading to imprisonment, the court in Scott v. Illinois, 1979, ruled that counsel did not need to be appointed. But in Alabama v. Shelton in 2002, all the way up to 2002, the court held that a suspended sentence that may result in incarceration can be imposed if the defendant did not have counsel at trial.
Yeah.
So they're saying it doesn't matter if it was a if that was the outcome. You still needed counsel.
Oh, absolutely.
As stated in Brewer v. Williams, 1977, the right to counsel means at least that a person is entitled to the help of a lawyer at or after the time that judicial proceedings have been initiated against him, whether by formal charge, preliminary hearing, indictment, information, or arraignment. Brewer goes on to conclude that once advisory proceedings have begun against a defendant, he has a right to legal assistance when the government interrogates him, and that when a defendant is arrested, arraigned, or an arrest warrant before a judge and committed by the court to confinement, there can be no doubt that judicial proceedings have begun. And it also clarified not until 2008 that the criminal defendant can be simultaneously competent to stand trial but not competent to represent himself.
Yeah.
So they had to make a distinction between the two.
I'll tell you, the real bright line where that test is shown a lot is in these smaller courtrooms like municipal courts, things like that, where basically people are fighting speeding tickets. Mm-hmm. Because just because you get a speeding ticket doesn't mean you have the right to counsel because it's not a jailable offense. But
right
now, here's the thing. If you get a speeding ticket and for whatever reason that speeding ticket would be like a misdemeanor that carried with it the possibility of a 6-month jail sentence, you'd have the right to have counsel present because it has basically that component of being incarcerated for it.
Right.
So that's really where the bright line distinction is. And you see that a lot in like smaller traffic courts and things like that. Speeding ticket, no counsel. Reckless driving, possible imprisonment. Get a lawyer for that.
Well, it amazes me when you look at some of these dates. Now, I know that to some people, 1972 seems like it was back in the dark ages. But to me, you know, that was a part of my life. So it doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
Yeah.
And that they're just then figuring out, oh, people might need counsel. It might be for things other than being feeble-minded.
Well, I think our representation of the lower socioeconomic people and their right to access to lawyers has really increased quite a bit in the modern era. I think back in the day, if you couldn't afford a lawyer,
you went to jail.
Tough.
Yeah.
So I think we've tried to even the playing fields on that quite a bit.
Justice is only for the wealthy.
Exactly. One of the other things that we've talked about before in the Sixth Amendment is the Confrontation Clause.
Yes, he got banned from the North Pole.
He got banned from the North Pole. And basically, one of the leading cases on this is actually a pretty recent case called Crawford v. Washington, and this is from 2004. And basically, what the Supreme Court held is that cross-examination is required to admit prior testimonial statements of witnesses who have since become unavailable. So traditionally, and under the rules of evidence, if you have a statement by somebody who is a possible witness and they become unavailable, you can try to enter their testimony in because they're unavailable. And there's a very specific test to determine what makes an unavailable witness, but we're not going to get into that. But essentially what you need to know is that they're an unavailable witness and there's a prior statement that the prosecution wants to get in, basically. So this Crawford v. Washington case is kind of interesting because it has a couple different issues. Michael Crawford and his wife Sylvia Crawford confronted Kenneth Lee over an allegation that Lee had attempted to rape Mrs. Crawford. Michael Crawford stabbed Lee in the torso. We're getting straight to the meat and potatoes. Stabbed him right.
Crawford, you did what? Stab
him. Crawford claimed he had acted in self-defense when he believed Lee had picked up a weapon. Lee denied doing anything that might make Crawford believe he was trying to attack them. So both Mr. and Mrs. Crawford were questioned by police after receiving a Miranda warning. Mr. Crawford said to police that he was not sure if Mr. Lee had a weapon, but that Crawford believed at the time Lee did. Mrs. Crawford, being interrogated separately, so they split him apart, at first said she had not seen the attack, but under further questioning said she had seen the attack and that Lee was not holding a weapon. So those were two kind of somewhat conflicting statements. And so at trial, Mrs. Crawford could not be compelled to testify by the state since under Washington's spousal privilege law,
right,
a spouse cannot testify in court without the accused spouse's consent.
Right.
Except whenever the other spouse is the victim in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So the deputy prosecutor wanted to introduce Mrs. Crawford's statement to police as evidence that Mr. Crawford had no reasonable belief that he was in danger for Mr. Lee. And so generally, like we had said, out-of-court statements are excluded as hearsay, but the court allowed it because the statement was reliable as it was partially corroborated by Mr. Crawford's statement to the police too. So the court took this analysis basically like, well, the witness is unavailable and it seems to be essentially pretty much reliable based upon some other things that are taken into evidence. So the defense counsel objected to the admission of the statement on the ground that Mr. Crawford would be unable to confront Mrs. Crawford on her statement without waiving a spousal privilege, and this would be a violation of the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. It's a pretty smart argument.
Yeah.
And the statement was allowed into evidence, and the prosecution relied on it heavily in their closing argument. So, no surprise, Michael Crawford was convicted, and basically the Washington Court of Appeals overturned the decision of the trial court, and then eventually the Washington Supreme Court reinstated the conviction and said that basically the witness statements were reliable under this Ohio v. Roberts case, which was a U.S. Supreme Court case that was on point. And so they appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari. So we know the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment basically provides that you have the right to confront all of your witnesses against you. Even though this is very spelled out quite specifically in the Sixth Amendment, sometimes a trier of fact can use out-of-court statements to get in, so it's not an absolute right. So under the analysis of the Ohio v. Roberts case, if a witness is unavailable, that witness's testimony can be admitted through a third person if it bears adequate indicia of reliability. And basically, it fell within some sort of firmly rooted hearsay exception or had particularized guarantees of trustworthiness. So basically, under that Ohio v. Roberts case, that probably was the right decision because they were applying the controlling case at that time.
You know what that reminds me of? The basis for that?
What's that?
It sounds like, remember when we talked about paternity, the episode on paternity?
Yeah.
And at one point in, I don't know whether it was France or whatever, where it was decided that the name that the woman shouted out in childbirth,
yeah,
was what? That's kind of like it. If it's something in the heat of the moment and somebody makes a statement that may be incriminating, and then later you can't make them bring it up legally, you can still use it because it was probably true because it was in the heat of the moment.
Now, Associate Justice Antonin Scalia, which a lot of people don't care much for Scalia, or he's got kind of a very polarizing view on the court. I like the way he interpreted things, so that he was very applied law very strictly, which I kind of like a little bit. But basically, Scalia expressed concern over the inconsistent results reached by the courts under the Ohio v. Roberts. And he thought the results of the Crawford decisions at various levels of Washington state courts kind of basically showed this problem. And in his opinion, he gave a thorough history of the Confrontation Clause and explained how the Confrontation Clause, using famous English cases of Sir Walter Raleigh, he described the he actually was talking about through the history. And he described the context in which the framers drafted the clause and displayed how early American courts interpreted it. And he basically, through this, he showed that the Confrontation Clause was basically trying to keep ex parte examinations out of the evidentiary record. And by ex parte, we mean that only one party has access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And relying on this, basically what Scalia said was, the framers would not have allowed the admission of testimonial statements of witnesses who did not appear at trial unless they were unavailable to testify and the defendant had had a prior opportunity for cross-examination. So Scalia determined that a prior opportunity for cross-examination was mandatory and dispositive of whether or not testimonial statements of an unavailable witness are admissible. Testimonial statements are formal declarations, those made to law enforcement or government personnel. Dispensing with the confrontation because testimony is obviously reliable is akin to dispensing with the jury because the defendant is obviously guilty. How's that for a good quote?
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah. So basically, under the Crawford thing, you have the Crawford thing. The Crawford court, you have the right to confront your witnesses under the Sixth Amendment. And basically what this did is this changed the way prosecutors were looking at their cases and how evidence was getting in. The main problem a lot of legal scholars had with this was basically, what is testimonial? And one area that lower courts are continuing to have trouble with was the use of 911 calls during the course of a trial where the caller is not available to testify. So you have this recorded statement of 911, but you're not able to actually cross-examine them. And this was the same factual situation in Davis v. Washington, and the court laid out a definition of testimonial. And basically the way that this comes in is that the 911 call is a different exception to the hearsay rule. These are certain types of business records or public records which are exceptions to the hearsay rule. So those come in evidentiary that way. So it's kind of a different kind of standard. So, but the Crawford thing, that was pretty much a big decision.
Along those same lines with hearsay and everything, they have the case Michigan v. Bryant from 2011. And the court ruled that the primary purpose of a shooting's victim statement as to who shot him must be that they were questioning him for this information. In other words, what they're saying is that one of these hearsay things where you don't have a chance, like say the gunshot victim then died.
Uh-huh.
If he's asking him for information, this is how they clarified it. If you're asking the person for information to try to determine who did the crime, then it's admissible. If they were asking them for information because they're trying to determine if the culprit may still be in the area, is he still armed, what does he look like, something like that, then it's not admissible.
Yeah.
Because you're not interrogating that person per se. In a way, that cop is taking the place of you or your lawyer being able to confront him by asking him direct questions to determine who did it. If he's asking him questions to determine something about the situation going on and not directly about the crime itself, then even though it's the same information, it can't be used.
Yeah. So basically, somebody's injured and they say, or shot, and they say, well, what's going on? Well, it was some guy had a red jacket or blah, 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 blah. Now, I mean, I guess in that circumstance, that actually might come in.
Well, I mean, if they said, it was Bobby Jones that shot me and he ran off over that way.
Yeah.
And, is he still armed? Yeah, he's still armed. But you didn't interrogate him. You're sure this is the guy that shot you. How do you know it was him? Uh-huh. Some of those follow-up questions, I would guess, is what they're saying. In other words, you specifically had to seek that information, not just trying to gain general information about your situation that is happening still,
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could also be...
That's a fine determination to make.
It could also be where they're talking to somebody about a different kind of case, about maybe a burglary that happened, and they're saying, the guy had on a pair of Air Force Ones and this, that, and the other, and whatever. And then the guy dies later on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's going to be hard to confront that guy who basically gave the eyewitness testimony as to what the guy was wearing. So that could be an issue too for the Confrontation Clause, because you can't confront that person at that point.
Right.
So
that's funny. I remember we went over that Sir Walter Raleigh case that you referenced.
Oh, did
when we? Yeah, when we covered that in one of our episodes, and we went over that. I don't remember what the case was, but I think it had to do with somebody having an affair and somebody getting killed as a result of it, or something along those lines. I remember that we did cover that.
Well, it was basically Sir Walter Raleigh was being tried for treason, and he made a demand, basically, in 1603, that he had a right to face his accusers. Raleigh's demand was denied, and a written statement of alleged co-conspirator was used as evidence against him without the witness appearing in court to answer the questions about the statement. He was convicted and spent the next 13 years in prison. So basically, that was the basis of that. It was a treason case.
Oh, okay.
Based upon a written
treason,
statement.
Treason, adultery, it's all kind of
based, same based upon a written statement, and he didn't have the chance to cross-examine that person. It was just a written statement.
So that was, they were correcting something that was done in England when they wrote that here.
Yeah, in the Crawford case.
That they felt Scalia. That was unfair.
Well, I think it's a fundamental part of jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. You have the right to confront your accuser in court.
I mean, right.
If somebody is saying something against you, you definitely have the right to have them say it to your face.
Well, yeah, an anonymous person leaving a note saying this happened, you can't trust that.
Yeah.
You have to be able to back it up with facts. Look them in the eye.
Exactly.
Tell me what you think. But it, I mean, all the different aspects of it have been challenged and gone to the Supreme Court. So, I mean, none of those things have been determined by the lower courts. They've all gone to the Supreme Court, every aspect that's in there. And there's like, what, six different things in the Sixth Amendment that it lists.
There's a lot.
And all of those have been challenged, or someone has tried to put an exact definition on it. And in most of the cases, while they have defined some of it, most of it is still kind of a case-by-case situation, or I'll know it when I see it.
Yeah, to a certain
degree. Like porn.
Yeah, to a certain degree. But I think the Sixth Amendment does play a crucial role in the rights of the accused, obviously. I mean, it's pretty prolific when it comes to that.
Well, just going by your checklist that you had there, that tells you that right there. Most of the questions had to do with the Sixth Amendment.
They did, yeah. They're not talking about... well, I mean, they do talk a little bit about the Fourth Amendment in there. I kind of skipped over that part. Basically, if you felt something had been, some evidence had been gained improperly, you have the right to challenge that and mm-hmm. things like that. But yeah, it's basically all about the Sixth Amendment for the most part. So, well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So the Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy about different legal phrases we talked about. And so, Tommy, you said the Sixth Amendment guarantees a lot of things. What do you think it guarantees without cheating and looking at your notes?
Oh, well.
I see you going for your glasses.
Yeah,
there.
I go over my glasses so I can read.
It's not an open book test.
Well, let's see. It guarantees you a speedy trial.
Yep.
A jury trial.
Yeah.
An impartial jury trial.
That's right. Impartial at that.
Yeah. It guarantees you right to counsel if you can't afford it.
Yeah.
It guarantees you that it's got to be held in the state where the crime happened.
Yep.
And let's see, what else? That you got the right to confront any accusers. And it also says that it has to be clearly stated what you're being accused of.
Yep. There's one more thing, and you'll have it perfect.
Oh, man. Let's see, because that was about six things. I was thinking there was only six things. I don't know.
Well, it has to do with witnesses.
Oh, you have the right to question any witness. Oh, you have the right to call your own witnesses if you have any to help you out.
That's right, and make them come to court.
Yeah, you can subpoena them.
You can what?
Subpoena them.
Subpoena?
Subpoena them.
It makes me really uncomfortable the way you say that. I don't know why.
Subpoena? I'm just subpoena them.
I think you're putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
I've had a subpoena before.
Good. What is the right to a speedy trial? How soon do you get to go to trial?
Well, there is no clear-cut definition. In general terms, it's about a year would be that, but it's a case-by-case determination. And the remedy, if it's not a speedy trial, is you get acquitted. They drop the charges against you.
And if you have counsel, what do they have to be?
Competent.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to have competent and effective counsel.
Do you remember the standard to determine whether or not the case from the standard to determine whether or not they were competent or not?
if they pass the bar.
It's a Strickland v. Washington. It was the two-prong test.
Oh, yeah.
And they actually has to show some sort of actual prejudice to them, that even though the lawyer screwed up all these things, that basically
That
would have affected the trial.
Yeah, because if they say they were errors, it wouldn't have made any difference.
That's right.
Then it doesn't matter.
Harmless error.
Yeah.
That was also the name of a lawyer softball team.
Harmless error?
The Harmless Errors. I thought that was pretty clever.
There is no harmless error in softball. They all have repercussions.
Now, I'm going to ask you, I didn't actually say this phrase, but you said it, and I told you what it meant. Informa pauperis.
That means that you've told them you're poor.
That's right.
The prince and the pauper.
That's prince and the pauper. The princess and the pea.
Yeah.
That's right. You did really well on this legal briefs.
Well, there's a lot of terms there.
This might be the best you've ever done, actually.
I don't know. I had one that I really nailed it there a while back, but this one felt pretty good. I felt pretty good about this one.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to go brag when I go upstairs.
Yeah.
About how good I did on it.
You're like an expert in the Sixth Amendment now.
I am.
You can advertise that way.
I'm an expert.
You can advertise that, right?
Yeah.
No, you can't say you're an expert.
Why not?
Because you're not.
I'm not a lawyer. I can say I'm an expert in anything. It doesn't matter. Remember, I'm one of those guys that you don't want to have give you cases because I could do anything.
That's true. You are full of puffery.
I am a puffery fish.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.